This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Peter Bogdanovich directed Kirsten Dunst in his most recent picture, The Cat's Meow, which came out earlier this year. His first picture starred Boris Karloff and opened up in movie theaters in 1968. It's been quite a career. The Last Picture Show, What's Up, Doc, St. Jack, Mask, and it's far from over. He's still working as a director. Mr. Bogdanovich is also familiar to a new generation from his appearances on the TV show The Sopranos. He plays the psychiatrist's psychiatrist. He's also a prolific and influential writer who's published books on the work of Orson Welles, Howard Hawks, John Ford, Alfred Hitchcock, among many others. Three of his earliest movies have just been released on DVD. They include that first feature, Targets, Paper Moon, which introduced Tatum O'Neill to movie audiences as the wise talking sidekick to a 1930s small-time con artist played by her father, Ryan O'Neill. She won the Oscar for that part. And his adaptation of the Henry James short story Daisy Miller, which starred Sybil Shepherd. You have the opportunity to talk to Peter Bogdanovich about Hollywood, old and new, about the great directors he's met and written about success and failure. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. As we mentioned, the 1968 Targets is one of the new DVDs. Here's Mr. Bogdanovich as Sammy the filmmaker and Boris Karloff.
He really knows how to tell a story.
Now look at this.
Indeed he does.
All the good movies have been made. What'd you do with my script?
Oh, I don't know. It's over there someplace.
I wrote a hell of a picture for you. For you as you really are.
A tired old man.
No.
Director, writer, and actor Peter Bogdanovich joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
You co-wrote that movie, Targets. That line, all the good movies have already been made. Is that your line?
Yeah. I've been asked a lot about that over the years.
I bet. Did you believe it at the time?
Uh-huh.
And do you think it now?
Well, kind of. the classic movies had all been made. I probably should have qualified it. There's plenty of room for good movies, but I think what I meant at that time, and still probably mean, is that the golden age of movies, which ended about 1962, had really covered all bases that it could cover, and then things changed, and it became a different medium, a different art form, a different way of making pictures. Everything changed, really. After that, and it has continued to change.
Well, change.
I guess it's a little bit too pessimistic a remark, but that was my poetic summation of the events at that time.
You made that movie Targets under some extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. It all happened because Boris Karloff, dear Boris Karloff, owed Roger Corman 2 days' work, and Roger thought he could exploit Boris and make a whole feature with Boris in only 2 days by shooting, just a few scenes with him and then shooting with other actors for about 10 days and stealing some footage from another Karloff picture that he'd made. So it was a kind of a crazy idea. And since I hadn't made a movie and since I was keen to, I agreed to it. And actually, things worked out quite differently. We ended up using Boris for 5 days, a whole 5 days, and shot about half the picture in 5 days, which was amazing. But he was an extraordinary man.
You're making your first feature, you're dealing with a man who is, he's been in a few of those classic movies that you were talking about.
He sure was. He was definitely a product of the Golden Age. I mean, he was in many, many silent films, and then with Frankenstein, he became a star and continued to mine that area of movie making, horror movies, basically, for the rest of his career. He was a lovely, lovely man, about as unlike his image as you can imagine.
Yet
a nice English gentleman, which is sort of what we wrote for him. And he was great in the picture. He always referred to it as his last movie.
He, as you say, quite a character. Were you intimidated by working with him?
Yeah, a little bit. He was terribly nice, though, and made me feel comfortable. He was funny. We were doing a scene together at one point. In the story, we both supposedly pass out from being drunk, and we end up passing out on the same bed in a hotel. No sexual implications in that innocent time. And we just passed out. And then morning, my character wakes up and sees him and does I jump being scared, and I make a joke about Boris Karloff being in the bed, you know. And then the script said I was supposed to laugh. And it's very difficult to laugh on cue. So we did a couple of takes, and I wasn't particularly good. I kept saying, this is no good, I'm sorry. It's hard to laugh. And then Boris says to me, well, dear boy, you don't have to laugh, you know. Just because you wrote it doesn't mean you have to do it. And I said, well, what'll I do? He said, well, don't laugh. And I said, okay, and I didn't laugh, and we got the take. So he was like that. He would just, you know, give me his opinion. But he was such a joy to work with all the way through.
I assume you cast yourself as the director, at least in part, to save some money.
I had written it for a friend of mine who was in New York and for whatever reason couldn't get out there, an unknown actor that I wanted to use that reminded me of a director. And I ended up doing it myself it wasn't to save money, it was just expedience.
Now, I wonder, speaking of older men, I gather that Targets was the only movie of yours that your father got to see. What did he make of it?
Well, you know, my father was a European gentleman and wasn't much of a talker, but he gave me a look that I'd never forgotten when the picture was over. And to this day, it kind of chokes me up thinking about it, I must say. It was just a look. It's hard to describe, but in the look, he gave me a look and he nodded. And the look conveyed a sense of tragedy of the kind of story that it was, after all, which is finally a story about random violence, about a person, a kid turning sniper and going out and shooting a lot of people randomly for no reason, apparently for no reason, which had happened in Texas.
The Texas Tower, yeah.
Yeah, with Charles Whitman, and then, you know, there's been a lot of that since then. And so the tragic implications of that story was the look was in his eye that said he understood the tragedy of the story. And on top of it, it was also pride in my having accomplished it, I guess, from the look. I'd done a good job. And so it was really just a look that he gave me. But, you know, I like silent movies, so it was a silent moment. And it reverberates to me the rest of my life, really.
Let's get some listener questions. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is the movie director, actor, and writer, Peter Bogdanovich. And let's go to Joe, who's with us on the line from Minneapolis.
Hello. Was wondering, Target is an outstanding movie. It's
called Targets, by the way. It's plural.
Yeah.
Targets, sorry.
That's all right. There is another movie called Target, singular.
Right, right.
But anyway, go ahead.
I saw it years ago in the 80s, I think, on television, and it didn't seem like it was available on video for many years. I was wondering if the subject matter had something to do with that. When I first saw it, it just seemed like it was kind of ahead of its time.
Well, I think people have said that. It sort of evoked a moment in time, and yet, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say that the kind of situation that it presents is not out of date. That's what's sad about the movie to me, is that it's still current. There are still people who do things like what the boy does in that film.
Yeah.
And the kind of horror that it describes, which is modern horror, is still unfortunately with us. I think its lack of availability. It was available on video off and on, but you had to find it. And this new transfer is beautiful. They did the original photographer, Laszlo Kovacs, supervised the transfer, and it's very beautifully done, as most DVDs are. And so it's the best version I've seen of the picture.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Joe.
Yep.
One of the fascinating things about that movie, Targets, I saw it first run. I'm feeling a little old myself. The contrast between that sort of Boris Karloff, 1930s horror movie, that familiarity of horror with the modern horror of the sniper who starts taking people out randomly, that's an eternal subject.
Well, unfortunately, it's still current. That's what's sad about it. I mean, here we are, and it's something you still pick up a paper and read about.
Let's go now to Joe, who's with us, another Joe, from Travis City, Michigan.
Yeah, actually,
Travis City, Michigan.
Steve Morton from Travis City, Michigan. And I worked with you in 1955 at the Cherry County Playhouse in Travis City.
Eleanor
Gould and a group from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah, God. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Yeah, this is Dave.
Dave. Oh, I see. They told me
Dave Fortin. I was the one local guy who took part, and one of the things that I remember about you is that you directed a review of the young people who put on different acts.
That's right.
And later, when you were successful, sometimes people will say, "How did that person go that far?" And I always tell people that, well, this guy was a writer, he was a dancer, he was a singer, and no matter what anyone's act was, he had something that he could add to it to make it better.
Well, that's
and that was my observation of you. And one of the things I wanted to ask, I had heard that your first film, now you talked about a feature there, and was something with John Cassavetes in it. Did you do something that was in a film festival prior to what you considered your first feature?
Well, I worked with John later, but not before. I worked with Roger Corman on a couple of pictures that were released prior to Targets. One was called The Wild Angels with Peter Fonda and Nancy Sinatra.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on that one, did the second unit, and so on. But I worked with John Cassavetes later.
Well, that was later.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that before the last picture show?
No, it was later than that.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to kind of straighten out my time frame. I work now as a television reporter, and I've been working with a lot of young independent producers who I'm getting a chance to do a few roles.
Well, that's
and,
good, Dave. I remember
make any money at it.
I remember Travis City very well. It was my first summer. I turned 16 that summer.
I remember.
And
later the Cherry County Playhouse has moved to Muskegon, Michigan.
Oh.
And it had some hard times, but it's now surviving very well.
Well, that's interesting. Thanks for the kind words, Dave. I appreciate it.
And thanks for the call.
Yes.
We just have a few seconds left in this segment, Peter Bogdanovich. And a hoofer? I didn't know you were a dancer.
Oh, well, he's exaggerating. I doubt that I really danced. I'm not much of a dancer. I probably moved a little bit.
We're talking with Peter Bogdanovich about his career and three new movies of his that are just out on DVD. When we come back, we'll talk about some more recent ventures as well. Did you know that he plays the shrink on The Sopranos? We'll also take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Peter Bogdanovich. Three of his early movies are just been released on DVD this week. Targets, Paper Moon, and Daisy Miller. If you have questions about those movies or any of his other work or about what he's written about the great directors of the 20th century, give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And Peter Bogdanovich, I understand we found you as you're finishing production on a biography of Natalie Wood. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, we're doing, we did a miniseries for ABC, which is going to be on sometime early next year, I think, about it's called The Mystery of Natalie Wood, so I guess that's what it's about. It takes her from her first movie when she was about five to her death. It's a sad story. I sort of fell in love with Natalie, the real Natalie, while making the film. Her performances in a number of movies are extraordinary. And I hadn't really taken her particularly seriously until I had to do this job. And then I now see that I was mistaken, because she was an extraordinarily talented actress.
What is the
difference? Had a sad life, a very complicated sad life.
Yeah. What's the difference between working in movies and making movies for television?
Speed. You have to go faster. That's the main difference. I mean, there are other differences, of course, because you have to, you know, think about commercials and breaking it at certain points and all those sort of things, and some things you can't do on television. But basically, I would say the biggest difference is just in terms of the speed with which you have to do it, you know, the speed with which you have to move. I'd say it's at least twice as fast as features.
I wonder if, in some sense, it isn't a little bit full circle going back to the economy of those early days with Roger Corman.
Well, it's what gets me through doing television. I like doing television, frankly. This is, I think, the fifth or sixth or seventh thing I've done for television. And I just directed an episode of The Sopranos, which is even faster. That's called episodic television, which, even though The Sopranos is a smash show, they still move very, very quickly. So if I'd say a television film is usually double time. The Sopranos was about triple time. But I don't mind the speed, you know. If you're healthy, you can do it. It gets the work done faster. But and I'm impatient, so it doesn't hurt. But it's much more difficult in a sense, because you just have to know what you're doing, and you can't afford luxury shots, and you can't afford to shoot things that you're not sure if you'll need, and you just have to kind of cut to the chase, you know.
You never said cue the iceberg.
No, I didn't say that.
Well, let's get another call. Joe joins us from Boise, Idaho.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. Real quickly, Mr. Bogdanovich.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration behind the casting of Ben Johnson? And also, what did you think of Love with the Proper Stranger with Steve McQueen and Natalie Wood?
Ben Johnson, I assume, in the Last Picture Show is
what
you're talking
about. Well, we had a tough time coming up with somebody for that part, and we thought of a bunch of different people from Nashville country singers like Tex Ritter to big stars like Jimmy Stewart, and we decided, although I don't know if we would have gotten either Tex or Jimmy, but suddenly it hit me, Ben Johnson. I had met him in the early 60s and, of course, loved him in the John Ford pictures. And it just struck me that he'd be perfect for it. I saw his photograph somewhere and said, wow, why didn't I think of him? And then we went after him and had a devil of a time getting him, because he didn't want to do it. He said it was too many words to learn, too difficult. And finally, John Ford got him to do it for me.
John Ford?
Yeah. He called him and put the heat on him. And I remember Ben called me back and said, you put the old man on me. And that sort of pushed him over the, and he agreed to do it, and then turned out winning an Oscar for it.
They sure did.
It was pretty surprising. But that's how it came about. He was wonderful in the picture. He only worked about 10 days. Love with a Proper Stranger, I just saw it a couple of times because I was working on this Natalie Wood thing. I thought the picture was kind of a nice picture, and I thought Natalie was superb. She really caught the flavor between the right balance between drama and comedy, which I didn't think Steve did as good a job on. He's all right, but she's really brilliant in it.
Thanks, Joe.
And the movie's very likable.
I was just going to.
All right. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Okay, sure. Joe. Appreciate it. We mentioned that the 1973 film Paper Moon is also among those being released on DVD. Let's listen to then 8-year-old Tatum O'Neill playing opposite her father, Ryan.
I want my $200. I heard you through the door talking to that man. It's my money you got, and I want it.
Now, you just hold on a second.
I want my money. You took my $200.
Will you quiet down? You hear?
I want my $200.
Hold on. Just hold on. Let me explain something to you.
It ain't as if you... you was my pa, that'd be different.
Well, I ain't your pa, so just get that out of your head. I don't care what those neighbor ladies said.
I look like
you. You don't look nothing like me. You don't look any more like me than you do that Coney Island. Eat that damn thing, you hear?
We got the same jaw.
Lots of people got the same jaw.
It's possible.
No, it ain't possible.
And I'm on my $200.
All right.
The voices of a real-life father and daughter, Ryan and Tatum O'Neill, playing 1930s con artists, and Peter Bogdanovich directed them in that film, and as we mentioned earlier, Tatum O'Neill won the Oscar for her performance in that picture as well. What was it like directing them?
Oh, it was fun. I mean, it was a job, but Ryan, of course, was superb, the best thing I think he ever did, and he really nailed that character. He came to me one day and he did this cackle, kind of laugh that was he does in the picture a few times. And I said, "That's it, that's the guy." And he just really understood how to do that. And anyway, he was terrific. And if it hadn't been for Ryan, of course, we couldn't have gotten that performance from Tatum, because he had to have an enormous amount of patience, because she was just a kid starting out. Had never done a picture and just had troubles, but she was so right for it, had this great voice and look. And so it was a question of getting it out of her, but she had it in her, obviously, otherwise she couldn't have done it. But it, you know, needed nurturing, and it needed patience from, particularly from her leading man.
I understood that when you were directing Kirsten Dunst in the most recent picture, you were drawing a comparison to how you were working with Tatum O'Neill in Paper
Moon. No. I've heard that said. That's absolutely not true. I think there was some conversation we had about people I'd worked with who hadn't worked much. But no, Kirsten is an extraordinarily talented experienced actress. And she's been working since she was about 4 or 5. No, it wasn't anything like working with Tatum.
No, I wasn't talking about working with her, but you had mentioned Paper Moon, and she had never seen it.
She'd never seen that or any of my pictures. And that's okay, I forgave her. I said, "Well, you might want to look at a couple." I said, "Did you see the last picture show?" She said, "I think I saw part of it." I said, "All right, forget it." But no, she was great to work with. But most young, she was only 18 when we did The Cat's Meow, playing 26. I think she did a hell of a job. But a lot of the younger people haven't seen older films, which I think is a fault. It's unfortunate, but that's just a fact of life.
Email question from Chad in St. Paul, Minnesota. Mr. Bogdanovich, are you familiar with the book Easy Riders and Raging Bulls? If so, what are your thoughts on its depiction of the new Hollywood and the idea that new Hollywood directors, including yourself, save the industry from itself with pictures like Bonnie and Clyde and The Last Picture Show, and then promptly ruined it with the invention of the blockbuster?
Well, the book has its people who like it, and I couldn't bring myself to read it. Somebody gave me a copy, and I looked at about 4 references to me in it, and every single one of them was wrong. So I just said, I'm not going to get upset about this book, so I didn't read it. But people who have read it, who are in it, like Coppola, I mean, they hated it. I guess they read it all the way through. They just thought it was full of mistakes and full of misquotes and so on. I suppose it certainly paints a sensational picture of that period, and the book did very well for its author. But I thought it could have been, from what I read, my stuff, it just seemed like it was a lot of inaccuracies.
Is it hard for you, as you're a great student of film and the movies, is it hard for you to think of the days when you started out as, you know, some sort of a distant golden age?
But it was kind of hard for me to think of it that way, because the golden age preceded us. We were sort of, I don't know what we were, but it was a somewhat baser metal than gold, that's for sure. I think it's true that the movie business collapsed as we knew it around 1962, and then there was a sort of dark age for about 5-6 years. And then pictures like Bonnie and Clyde and Five Easy Pieces and John Cassavetes' Faces and Picture Show and whole bunch of movies that were made by younger directors that started around that time. That did sort of change Hollywood for a period of time. It changed it not It just changed it, and the youth culture took over. And then the blockbuster mentality came in the mid-70s, and that sort of did not, I don't think, affect us artistically very well. But I don't think it was a golden age, but I'm perfectly happy if somebody wants to think of it that way.
Email question from Mick Hilgers. Very much enjoyed your book. This is Orson Welles, he writes, and would like to know what you consider to be the greatest lesson or lessons you learned from Mr. Welles.
Well, I knew Orson. I was fortunate enough to know him for about 15 or 16 years, and I learned a lot from him. Some things not so good, but mostly very good. And it's just too many things to put it into a brief answer, but he just taught me an awful lot. Taught me about lenses. He taught me about certain things about actors and about making films, and just generally his spirit. He had a very youthful spirit, no matter how old he was, and that was infectious. The sense of, you know, try anything, you can do anything. He was wonderful that way, and it was just a privilege to know him.
I wonder if you learned anything from him about the arc of a career. He had, of course, you know, huge, enormous success with his first picture, Citizen Kane, and then later in life had trouble getting money to make any movies at all.
Well, the thing is about Orson, which is somewhat misunderstood, is that Citizen Kane got very good reviews but did no business. The reason it did no business was because it had been blacklisted by the Hearst organization, so a lot of theaters wouldn't play it, all the Hearst papers wouldn't run ads for it. So as a result, it economically did not succeed, and it was considered a failure. And in fact, it disappeared. That came out in 1941. It disappeared.
Didn't it win Best Picture?
No. It was nominated. Yes, it did get a bunch of nominations. It won only one. It won for screenplay. But it was a kind of a consolation prize.
Mm-hmm.
But the picture financially, the only thing that counts in Hollywood really in terms of filmmaking is if the picture makes money. And unfortunately, none of Orson's pictures made a lot of money. The only picture of his that made any money that he directed was a little thriller he made called The Stranger with Edward G. Robinson and Loretta Young and himself. But that was the kind of movie he didn't really want to make, so he decided to go it alone and went to Europe and made pictures his own way. And he made some great films after that, but nobody saw them. And it isn't until after he died, so to speak, that people have begun to realize, you know, that he did leave something quite extraordinary behind besides Citizen Kane.
We're speaking with director Peter Bogdanovich. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here's another email question from Rick Barron in Boulder, Colorado. I read a quote from Alfred Hitchcock in which he noted that by the time one of his films made it to the first day of shooting, it was already completed in his head. He completely storyboarded every scene, including every camera angle before he shot one. That seems to be in complete contrast with current filmmaking, in which it seems nobody knows what the ending might be until perhaps all of the scenes have been shot. Any comments on the differences?
Well, Hitchcock certainly knew what the picture was going to look like. He visualized the picture as he was working with the writers on the script, and he kind of wrote it the way he saw it. And yes, there were often storyboards, and he liked to work that way. He liked to have it sort of in his head. I think he exaggerated slightly. I saw him on the set. I think he exaggerated slightly that, you know, when he said it was completely finished and there was nothing left to do, because there was a lot of work that he did with the actors that was rewarding and integral to the whole success of the project. But the difference between then and now is gigantic, and unfortunately, most filmmakers today don't know what the picture's going to look like, which is why one of the reasons pictures cost so much is because there's so much shooting that ends up being unused. You know, every day, time is money on pictures, so if you shoot 15 setups, 15 shots, and you really only need three, there's a day's work that, you've wasted. And that's what happens a lot. It's just kind of, it's not that interesting to the public, but that is what takes an awful lot of time, is that there aren't enough directors around who know what they want.
Let's get another call. Krista joins us from Wichita.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Mr. Bogdanovich. I'd like to know how you think the film industry has changed throughout your career, given that
we're
in the age of the blockbuster. Is it any more challenging for directors to make and find an audience for really quality films now versus when you started?
Yeah, I think it is more difficult. There's been a revival of interest in the smaller film, thanks to Miramax and others. The independent film movement still has an impact, and I think there's some awfully good work being done for less money. But it is much more difficult than it used to be. When I started making pictures, the whole blockbuster mentality didn't exist, and the whole idea of a picture having to open with a gigantic weekend and all that never existed. The whole sort of hit parade, you know, box office hit parade notion of movies, that really didn't start until somewhat toward the end of the 70s. And I think it's diminished movies. I mean, when you realize a film like The Last Picture Show, which was very inexpensive, black and white movie with no names in it, we opened that picture in one theater in New York, one theater in Chicago, one theater in Los Angeles, and it sat there for about 3-4 months before it opened wider. It didn't open wide, as they say, until it was nominated for some Oscars. That kind of opening of a movie doesn't happen anymore. It's very rare.
Krista, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Peter Bogdanovich, I'm afraid we're out of time. There's a million more questions we could ask, but we appreciate your time today.
Well, sure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate your interest.
Peter Bogdanovich speaking with us from Los Angeles, where he's just wrapping up production on a TV movie about the life of Natalie Wood. Three of his early movies are out on DVD this week: Targets, Paper Moon, and Daisy Miller. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We'll be right back.